This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So this class is about building multi-rotor aircraft. So you've seen quadcopters, some people call them drones, people fly them around, they've been in the news a lot lately. And they're a really interesting kind of electronics project, and it's something the students are pretty interested in. And so we're using it to teach them how to build printed circuit boards and simple electronics, and then make the software work along with that so that they'll fly and they'll be able to control them by remote control. So this is a capstone class, so the students are mostly seniors from computer science and electrical engineering, and we have one person from mechanical engineering. And so we kind of targeted at seniors. The class is pretty small because it's pretty intensive as far as teaching it and managing it goes.
I was mostly hoping to learn about, first of all, hardware design, because I had never done any of this before. So all the PCB design, all that sort of thing was new to me. And that was something I felt like I should have learned by now, just being a computer engineering major. But I've always been more interested in software, so I just never took a class like this before. So PCB design was a big one. And then also, because I've been interested in quadcopters for a while now, I wanted to learn how the software actually worked.
I was really hoping to, you know, have a fun project that I could work on, kind of. Being a class, it would kind of force me to work on some things, kind of dig into it, have more resources available than just something I was doing on my own.
The skills that you learn in building one of these quadcopters, you could use to build all kinds of electronics. It's the same basic process that you use to build iPhones or laptop computers, or if you're a maker and you want to build some electronics for a piece of electronics art or any other project, the same kind of tools and techniques are what we're teaching them.
Everybody, all of our groups, we designed the layout of our circuit boards from scratch. So we kind of had some parts, we kind of had a circuit we started from, but everybody kind of customized their circuit, and then we all designed the final board that we made. So each group has a different board.
So what they've learned so far is they've learned about printed circuit boards. We've talked a little bit about how they've manufactured. And then they've spent a lot of time learning how to design the printed circuit boards. So that means building a schematic, which sort of defines the electrical connections between the components on the board. And they also have to design kind of the engineering information about the parts themselves, so how big they are, where the electrical connections need to be for a particular LED or a capacitor or a microcontroller. Probably the biggest and hardest part is actually laying out the board. And that's where they define the shape of the board, and they have to take into account a bunch of different physical constraints. The motors have to fit right, has to be the right shape. There's a limit on how large a board we can manufacture. And there's also some kind of complicated electrical constraints that they have to meet to make sure the motors get enough power, to make sure the radio doesn't get interference from the motors, things like that.
One of the cool things about this class is a lot of people came in with different backgrounds. And so some of us knew how to do the software, some of us knew how to do hardware, some people, like, I think I might be the only one, but I came in knowing a lot about quadcopters and not too much about the hardware or software behind them. So I think if you have any interest and you feel like you're lacking in one of those areas, it's a really good class to both learn something and do something fun, a fun project.
So building something and seeing how those parts work together, I think, is really valuable. You know, employers really like hands-on projects. You know, if you do a programming class, you know, maybe your code worked and maybe it didn't, but, you know, if we have some video of your quadcopter flying, then, you know, clearly you got your quadcopter to fly. And that's not something that can happen by accident.
The proof is in the flying quadcopter. During the course of the quarter, I figured out a goal and I built the product, got the product working, debugged everything, and then at the end of the quarter, I had something to show off. That's not something you really do in a lot of your classes. So I think it's really important to kind of round out your education where you actually build something. You know, fully follow a product through from start to finish. Set a goal. If your goal is to get a flying quadcopter, go all the way through, do all the steps until you have a working product that you can show off. Not just for your own education, but also it's a great thing to put on a resume.
There's a lot of interest among the students and also among their potential employers in building things. There's the Internet of Things, where everything is going to be connected. And really, an Internet of Things device is, in a lot of ways, very similar to this. It'll have a little microcontroller, which provides a little bit of compute. It'll have some radios and some sensors. And so they're prepared to go out and build that kind of stuff. And they know what goes into it. And so if someone asks them someday to go build a little gadget, hopefully they won't think that that's overwhelming. They'll say, oh, I know how to do that. I hope that some of them will want to go out and actually build real stuff. It's lots of fun.
The human microbiome is a complete collection of genes that are encoded in their genomes. What they do for us is amazing. In addition to the microbes in your gut digesting your food, they also play all kinds of other roles in educating the immune system, in producing vitamins and other chemicals that are necessary for our health, and in making us resistant to disease. My name's Rob Knight. I study the microbial world at the University of California, San Diego, where I lead the new microbiome initiative. I'm a professor in the departments of pediatrics and computer science and engineering. I've been interested in science of the natural world from as long as I can remember. I grew up in Dunedin, New Zealand, so it's on the South Island. It's a beautiful place. I first lived in the US from 1985 to 1987, and my parents were both working at NIH at the time. I came back to the US in 1996 to enter grad school at Princeton, and I've been here ever since. The microbes on our skin, in addition to helping us resist disease, do all kinds of other things. Like, for example, they determine whether or not we're particularly attractive to mosquitoes. You might be 10 times as attractive to mosquitoes as your camping buddies. And so while you're swatting away there and they're completely unaffected, it might be because your microbes on your skin are producing chemicals that make the mosquitoes zoom in on you and leave the other people in your party alone. You can see the 384 well plate with the really tiny holes in it, and then the ones with the bigger holes are 96 wells. And you can just imagine how miserable it is to take each of these plates and fill it up with 10 different components. So the work in my lab over the past decade has been primarily focused on better ways to read out microbial communities, whether they're the microbiome in our bodies or whether they're microbial communities all over the Earth's surface. And microbes play all kinds of important roles in the sea, in the soil, even in the air. And we're just starting to discover what many of those roles are now. In human health, my research specifically has linked microbes to obesity, to malnutrition, to inflammatory bowel disease. My current inspirations, and especially my inspiration for moving to a department of pediatrics, is really in the potential of the microbial world to improve health for everyone across the planet, and especially the increasing evidence that we're getting that most of what happens in microbial development happens in the first 3 years of life. In terms of what we'll be able to do in biomedical science in the near future, there's some very exciting possibilities. For example, improved diagnosis in cases where different disease subtypes have different microbes involved with them. In what's called patient stratification, so basically being able to predict whether a particular drug will work for you based on your microbiome before you try taking the drug. The United States is really the central hub for microbiome research. There's a lot of private philanthropy in the US, and that's been very important for the microbiome field, in part because it connects so closely to human health and to the environment. What's next for my journey is being able to take the pattern discovery that we've been doing in the microbiome and take it to a whole new level of understanding the functions of the organisms and the chemicals that they produce, and being able to reshape the communities and perhaps even reshape the genomes of those organisms so that they can do things that are more beneficial for us, either in a health context or in an environmental context.
Geysers are fascinating natural phenomena. Right? 3 million people go to Yellowstone, they watch geysers erupt, and they all ask why. And we don't know the answer to that question. To make a geyser, you need heat, you need fluid, and just the right geology. So they're very uncommon features. And the fact that they're uncommon tells us that there's something special or unusual about how they work. Why do they erupt regularly, or sometimes not regularly? And this is all controlled by the pressure and temperature underground. But it's a little bit unpredictable, and then it just happens. And people can watch geysers erupt time and time again. They'll spend hours and hours just watching and waiting. The key measurement for us to make is to measure pressure and temperature within the geyser, and also to see what the inside looks like. At Yellowstone National Park, we're limited to making measurements outside of the geyser. We measure the ground motion with things called seismometers to record the ground vibrating. A variety of measurements to look at how the ground is deforming and how fast material comes out of the geyser. In Chile, we're allowed to put instruments inside the geyser as well. So we use the same types of measurements. We leave the equipment inside the geyser for 5 or 6 straight days. With the video camera, we can see where the steam is coming from, through all the nooks and crannies in which steam can accumulate, the convoluted pathways through which the water has to move. And that inspires the lab models that we built here in Berkeley. So at the bottom of the geyser, we have a hot plate. It's kind of like a stovetop, and it's heating the geyser. In the earth, this corresponds to the hot rock deep underneath the ground. And heat is transferred from the hot rock into the water, into the geyser, and the heat accumulates inside the geyser system. And then at the top here is where water is ejected into the atmosphere, and that's what you see when you go to Yellowstone. One thing we've observed at geysers is 2 types of eruptions, small ones and big ones, and this bubble trap now helps us understand why we have small and big eruptions. Every now and then a little bubble will leak out the top, and that makes a small eruption that just happened. And eventually all this water gets hot enough that one of those small little eruptions turns into a big eruption. When a big eruption happens, everything reaches the boiling temperature. Water at the top, water at the bottom. And as soon as the eruption begins, the pressure everywhere is lowered and the water turns into steam. And then we get a big eruption.
It looks like we don't have any consecutive large eruptions.
So we need to figure out why, right? Why it's so irregular.
Today we're measuring the temperature in the bottom and the top of the model, and then the other lines we're looking at are temperature of our heat source and temperature of the surrounding air, just so we can see that our environmental conditions are constant. We leave this model running for hours and hours, sometimes days. You know, come in and check on it every few hours, but what we want to get is a lot of data. We also record video of the model so we can go back and look at different characteristics of the eruption. But temperature is our most important measurement, I think, because it's easy to pick out the big eruptions in a temperature record. There's no eruption at the moment, but we can see these little fluctuations in the top and bottom temperature recordings, and those are the signatures of bubbles rising up through the conduit, and they're transferring heat, and that's a temperature change.
So it's exciting to finally make measurements in a geyser and understand what's going on, why the eruptions start, why they end. But there are many things we don't understand. Real geysers are regular. Old Faithful is called Old Faithful because it's regular. The geysers in Chile erupt every 132 seconds, one we studied. It doesn't matter whether it's night or day, cold or warm. So even though we understand many features of how the eruptions work, there's still basic questions that we don't understand. And so hopefully we can go back and make more measurements.
Is it time to eat?
Not yet. I just found out how tiny magnets can be. Check this out.
If we look at the structure of a material, we can actually see these tiny magnets. That's just what we're seeing here. These different shaded blobs are actually clumps of atoms in which all the electrons are spinning the same way. So in a way, we're seeing a tiny magnet. This little pile of atoms has one magnetic field with a north and south end, just like any other magnets. On average, there are a few thousand atoms or so across. They're called domains.
Holy hairball, smart puppy! That is tiny!
That's right, kitties!
Now is it time to eat?
Ha! California agriculture basically reinvents itself every generation.
How are we going to feed the growing population by 2050?
There's three fans here. The seed is sort of the Silicon Valley of the agricultural world.
How are we going to double our food supply?
We've reduced the chemical application by 75 or 90%.
So this arm actually swings out.
And the only answer is ag technology.
Ag technology. It creates the ability to grow plants that are disease resistant, equipment that can target individual leaves, and strands of rice that can survive drought, flooding, and literally save lives. Farming may be one of the oldest, most traditional occupations known to man, but today it's on the cutting edge. Scientists at UC Davis say, and farmers agree, that it has to be if we want to feed a growing population with a shrinking amount of farmland. But as with any change, there is often controversy.
So the tofu is sautéing.
Welcome to Taco Night at the Adam Check and Ronald household. It's pretty typical of taco nights that happen all across our country all the time. Except maybe that their connection with food, as well as where it comes from, may run a little deeper than most.
Food has been altered genetically for 10,000 years. A lot of people don't know that everything we eat has been genetically altered in some way.
Pamela Ronald is a plant pathologist at the UC Davis Genome Center. Raul Adamczyk is the manager of the market garden at the UC Davis Student Farm. This couple represents two very different systems of food production. He farms organically. She genetically modifies plant seeds for use in conventional farming. They're two worlds that are traditionally at odds.
There is a national law, the National Organic Standards, that came about in the year 2000, was developed by the USDA. And in that law, genetic engineering is not allowed to be used in organic agriculture.
Raul and Pam both believe that the national organic standards have influenced what many people think about the genetic engineering of food.
It's very good, sweet corn, too.
When in reality, they often don't understand what exactly genetic engineering is or what it does.
People have associations with plant genetics as some kind of foreign technology. And there's concern, they've heard that companies make seeds, corporations breed different varieties, and they're probably not aware that virtually all farmers in the United States do buy seeds, including organic farmers.
So here's a quick lesson. In plant breeding, genes are transferred between the same species to create a desired characteristic. So a disease-resistant peach, for example, might be crossed with a high-yielding but susceptible peach, with the goal of creating a peach that's both high-yielding and disease-resistant. In genetic engineering, genes can be transferred between different species. A life-saving example is golden rice, soon to be released on the market. The new rice contains beta-carotene derived from daffodils and is believed to meet a vitamin A deficiency in underdeveloped nations that currently causes 550,000 children to go blind each year and half of them to die.
People, I think, aren't really clear as to why, what the benefits are of genetically engineered seed and why farmers want it.
The benefits, Ronald says, are clear. With genetic engineering, scientists are able to create seeds that solve problems. They can fight pests, withstand drought or flooding, be hardier, more abundant, the list goes on and on.
Considering the population of our planet is already surpassing the amount of food available, experts say being able to invent crops that meet demand and fight farming challenges will be essential, both for feeding people and protecting our environment.
One of the major products that is on the market is insect-resistant crops. That is cotton, for example, or corn that produce their own resistance to insects. This has enormously reduced the use of pesticides. Prehydrate them, that is.
Kent Bradford is director of the Seed Biotechnology Center on the UC Davis campus. Ironically, it sits not far from the organic market garden and is probably one of very few places on the planet where you'll find such traditionally opposing viewpoints working practically side by side. That's because Bradford, the director, and Ronald, a geneticist, want the same thing that organic farmer Raul Adamczyk and this farmer and this farmer and this farmer wants, an abundant, safe food supply that doesn't harm the environment in the process.
And the goals really are, how can we produce enough food to feed the world. The food needs to be safe. It needs to be, we need to reduce some of the toxic inputs.
All of these advances are targeted really toward reducing the footprint of agriculture, reducing the inputs, making agriculture more sustainable as well as more compatible with the environment.
Scientists say solutions to many of the biggest food producing challenges already exist. Their biggest obstacle is getting consumers to understand the benefits. Currently, testing is much greater for genetically engineered products than it is for other new products, which means a greater expense and a greater length of time to get a potentially life-saving or crop-saving seed onto the market. So the innovation that scientists and students are working on right now may not be able to help us for another decade or longer.
So this is the walnut breeding program at UC Davis, and we are creating new varieties of walnuts for the future generations of farmers.
Graduate student Krista Freilinger says 90% of walnuts grown in California are ready for harvest at the same time. She's trying to create a tree that fights common walnut pests and diseases and can produce nuts throughout the year. Similar breeding was done long ago on iceberg lettuce, something consumers now take for granted.
We plant lettuce in California every day, and to produce that identical head of lettuce throughout the state every day, we need 30 to 60 different varieties every year during the course of the year.
Plant geneticists could likely find similar solutions for many common and healthy foods, solutions that would produce more of these foods and would enable farmers to use less water, which is in short supply, and fewer chemicals, if any at all.
It's hard to imagine that we're going to have more land suddenly come into production. So we're going to have to be much more efficient with what we have.
It's not hard to figure out that in order to feed our population and protect our environment, we're going to have to farm smarter using tools that work better. And that's where precision farming comes in.
Generally doing things that is much more localized on a spatial basis. So rather than farming a field, you might farm individual plants, or you might eventually farm individual leaves or smaller and smaller areas.
Here at the Western Center for Agricultural Equipment on the UC Davis campus, tools for improved farming are born.
I like to sit there and, you know, engineer stuff and design stuff, follow through with calculations, and then go out and actually build it. And I think it gives me an edge on other engineers out there in the field that don't have this practical knowledge.
Dasa will someday return to his family farm in Stockton as a fourth-generation cherry and walnut farmer. But in the meantime, he hopes to make his mark on the industry by creating equipment that will require fewer chemicals, making farming more economical, efficient, and productive.
With a very targeted application, you can reduce that volume of water and chemical to still achieve a level of protection on your grapes.
Ryan Billing created technology and an improved system for spraying plants as an undergraduate project and finished it while pursuing a master's degree here at UC Davis. He now works on campus as a development engineer.
I hope this machine makes it to the market and allows farmers to pass their farms along to their next generation.
And that's what it's really about. Continuing the tradition of working the land and feeding our families. It's another aspect of sustainability. It's part of the reason why UC Davis is focused on exploring genetic engineering as well as new ways to farm organically.
Why don't you have some salad on your tortillas?
It's also why an organic farmer and a genetic engineer, sharing values, can find common ground as they raise a family while living under the same roof.
Having the same values and having the same goals and just coming from a different point of view to get there.
When it comes to how food is grown, there may always be passionate advocates on opposite sides of the road. But at UC Davis, researchers, educators, and even students believe that all roads essentially lead to the same place, a place where food is abundant and safe and the environment is thriving. A place where sustainability isn't a hope or a goal, it's a way of life.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.